All right, everyone. Welcome to another edition of our Tax Town Hall. Joe Bannister here with Larry Beecraft. Our other co-hosts, Sean O'Connor and Gary Thomason, couldn't be with us tonight. So let's begin as we always do with our prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. All right. Well, Larry is going to continue his presentation on litigation, talking about civil litigation, criminal litigation, and the foundation of it, the history of it. We went through quite a bit last week. And so, Larry, please continue.
Well, Joe, I have on the screen the contact information for the host.
Let me get. So, do you want to see which the FRC?
Well, what are our cameras on? One of the things I'd like to bring up during the course of the what I'm going to talk about this evening, I emailed to you last week those table of contents for the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure and the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. There were two files. They may have been attached to each other or one file. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, back out of that.
Okay.
I'll tell you when to pull it up. That's what I want you to have handy.
All right.
Well, let's start. You know, I've been involved with the freedom movement for decades. I go back into the late 70s and early 80s when Tupper Saucy was running around the country. He was heading up the money issue. You know, a lot of people were interested in the money issue, and they still are. You know, it was one of the reasons why I got involved with this movement, because of Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the United States Constitution. No state should make anything other than gold and silver coin tender payment of debts. And the design of the Constitution was to ensure that our money would be based on gold and silver coin. But, you know, back in those days, there was also a number of people that were equally interested in not only the money issue, but also the tax issue. And I've just seen over the years that the people that have been interested in these two issues, you know, there's kind of an ebb and flow. You know, for a while, there'll be some noteworthy people out there, you know, like, for an example, I give you Bob Schultz. Bob Schultz started in the late 90s. That's what got you involved, Joe. You know, Bob Schultz comes along. You know, so periodically you'll have somebody like Bob Schultz, or you'll have some leaders like John Kottmeyer with Save the Patriot Fellowship that come along to do a lot of promoting of the tax issue. These are really important issues. Now, over on my website, as Joe showed a minute ago, the way to get to my website is to use a start engine. Start page is a search engine. Go over to Beecraft Briefs or the Dixieland Law Journal, and you will find that my website is devoted a lot to the money issue and the tax issue. Now, there's specific reasons why the money issue and the tax issue are so blooming important. You know, looking at, you know, here we today, we've got this great political theater that America's being exposed to right now, sponsored by the Democrats. You know, they're very liberal, but, you know, they're behind the liberal facade. You know, now we've got some people that are openly advocating socialism. Well, socialism and communism goes all the way back to Karl Marx. And I mean, Karl Marx, who wrote his Communist Manifesto in 1848 and published it, you know, he had some planks in the Communist Manifesto. And the second plank of the Communist Manifesto was this requirement. If you want to take over a society, you know, this is the way they thought back in those days. You know, things are a lot more sophisticated now. But back in the days when Marx wrote, you know, the first publication of the Communist Manifesto, he outlined 10 planks that was needed in order to, for a communist society to exist. The second plank was a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. And that's something that, you know, besides being interested today in the tax issue, you know, we got to understand that you know, this institution that we're talking about, the income tax, it's a plank in the Communist Manifesto. Now another plank in the Communist Manifesto is plank number five. Plank number five is this requirement. There must be a centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. Now, if you know something about the money issue, the history of the money issue in our country, you know, we wanted by means of the United States Constitution to establish a monetary system that's based on gold and silver coin. But then right after the Constitution went into effect, you know, the banking industry, you know, capital, you know, the credit creators, they really got their start, you know, right about the time that the United States Constitution was adopted, when the federal government came into existence. You know, that's really when banking got its start in this country. Now, if you want to know something about the early days, if you want to read some textbooks written by some of the men that lived back in those days, go over to my website. I've got a substantial part of my website devoted to the money issue. And, you know, like, for example, Joe, go down and click on money and economics. And here, you know, I've got a lot of material by Edwin Vieira. But, you know, go down to the Royal Bank. You know, there's a history of John Law's banking experience in 18th century France. Now, I just scanned and converted to text a book, copyrights no longer applicable to this particular book, called Men of Wealth. I scanned and converted to text. You know, it's a lot, you know, I like doing it, you know, cleaning up a book and converting it to text. And so now it's in this PDF image you can download from my website. It was about a 70 or 80 page book, and I just converted, but it's real good. This, you know, this little work right here was good about talking about how the banks in England got started from John Law's experiment. So John Law is really the modern era's promoter of the first banks in the Western world. And of course, by the 1790s and the early 1800s, you know, banking was getting it started here in the United States. Now, Joe, back out of that, and let's go to some other historical works. For no editorial, people need to read that, but go down to A Short History of Paper Money, William Gouge. Now, William Gouge was in the President Andrew Jackson, his administration. Andy Jackson was opposed to the banks, the way that they were operating. And so was William Gouge. He was a student of the money issue back in those days. So he wrote some very important works that were describing the events of, you know, prior to 1833 in reference to the banking system we had in this country. So, you know, these matters, like William Gouge coming out with his book on banking, you know, here it is, 1833, when he's writing it. And then a mere 15 years later, we got the Communist Manifesto coming out, being published by, written and published by Karl Marx. And Karl Marx talks about, you know, what a society needs in order to become a communist society is two planks, are a progressive income tax and centralization of credit in the hands of the state. Now, here, and we haven't really gotten to the part of centralizing credit in the hands of the state, really, as Marx envisioned it back in those days. We don't have a direct counterpart to it today, but we got something real close. We got the Federal Reserve System starting in 1913. It is, you know, it is creating the credit that's keeping the money system that we have here in this country going today, you know. It's real important that we have the Federal Reserve. So there's a great, it's highly similar that the system that we have in this country can fit within the proposition of the fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto of centralization of credit in the hands of the state. So it's for these reasons that, you know, we got the income tax and we got the centralization of credit in the hands of the state. Those are two planks of the Communist Manifesto that a lot of people can say are harmful for the American people. And that's the reason why we have such an interest in, you know, dealing with these issues, the money issue and the tax issue. That's the reason why it's incredibly important. You know, a lot of people want to look at the money issue and the tax issue as, you know, issues that affect them on an individual level rather than issues that affect the whole of society. You know, I think people need to be interested in these two issues because they need to look beyond their own circumstances. They need to understand that this is a real problem that confronts all of America. It's an issue of concern that affects everybody. So every American, including liberals, but especially Republicans and conservatives, they need to be concerned about these two issues. They need to know something more about the legal system, you know something about the income tax laws, know something about the banking systems. And of course, that's the reason why I've got a lot of information over on my website. Now, before we get a little bit further into what I want to talk about tonight, which are, you know, is it kind of an overview of the civil litigation system, I want to point out something that's real, you know, the reason why legal principles are so important, and I want to talk about an equal protection argument tonight. The reason why these arguments are so important is because as we go through this political theater that we're experiencing today, you know, 10 years ago, we were having Obama and his folks talking about Obamacare. Now we're dealing with this issue of the Second Amendment. You know, we've got people that want to engage in gun control. But when you listen to those type of people that are discussing the pros and cons of just Obamacare and the gun issue, you know, a lot of people don't realize, they don't understand that there are some legal arguments that need to be a part of the discussion. And I would like to bring up one of those, an argument that applies to both Obamacare and the gun control laws, to show why it's so important that not only do people need to be conversing with, you know, how do we fight the income tax system and the credit system, because there are parts of the Communist Manifesto. The reason why we need to be involved with and conversant with legal arguments is because they do have an everyday application in our lives. And that's, I want to bring up an equal protection argument to show that here today, in reference to Obamacare and the Second Amendment and gun control issue, we have a real important issue that people can understand. And once you understand this legal issue, then you can, you know, you can see how it applies in ordinary, everyday American society. And what am I talking about? You know, this legal principle that people need to know something about. Equal protection. Well, you know, the first time equal protection becomes a fixture in constitutional parlance is by means of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. As a result of the Civil War, the 14th Amendment was proposed. It was allegedly ratified. And one of the provisions of the 14th Amendment says that no state shall deny equal protection of the laws. Well, what in the world is equal protection? Equal protection deals with the issue of to paint the broad parameters of equal protection requires a kind of a theoretical, at least, understanding of the power of a legislative body. You know, when a legislative body comes along and addresses a particular problem and wants to solve a great social problem, a problem being confronted by that society, you know, that is subject to the laws of that legislature. You know, when a legislature starts to address some social problem, you know, the equal protection principles come into play. And here's the way they come into play. You know, the legislative body could come along and to solve a particular problem, they could pass some law that is overbroad, or they might pass some law that is not nearly as broad as it needs to be. Now, equal protection deals with classifications of parties that are subject to laws. When a legislature is trying to address a problem, it needs to draft the legislation and make it applicable to that particular problem. It can't be overbroad or it can't be under-inclusive. Now, let me explain those two categories. Let's say that drunk drivers pose a problem for a state legislature. Let's take Tennessee, you know, just as an example. Let's say that 10% of the drivers in Tennessee are really causing a problem due to because of their activities of involving drunken driving. You know, Tennessee's got a lot of breweries up there. You know, we got just over the line from where I am here in Alabama. There's a noteworthy, famous national brewery in Southern Tennessee. Southern Tennessee, all over Tennessee, you got breweries. They sell White Lightning in Tennessee. So let's presume that the Tennessee legislature wants to solve some problem being caused by drunk drivers. So they pass a law. Now, if the equal protection principles say, well, the solution to the drunk driving problem should be applicable to drunk drivers. But if they made the law to apply to every member of the driving public in Tennessee, and it would trample upon their rights, then that's what is called, pursuant to equal protection principles, as being over-inclusive. It's broader than it needs to be. So, you know, if the solution to Tennessee's drunk driving problem is to pass a law applicable to all Tennessee drivers, that is an over-inclusive classification. Now, let's suppose that instead of drafting a law that applied to just to drunk drivers, let's say that they said the law only applied to drunk drivers who happened to be redheaded. Well, now, instead of making it the solution to the problem being envisioned to affect drunk drivers, now it's only envisioned to affect and is designed to affect only a small part of the people that are causing the problem. Now, that is called an under-inclusive classification for equal protection principles. Now, now that you've seen these, I've explained to these very simple equal protection principles, now let's apply them to Obamacare. Let's apply it to the gun control issue. And this should be an explanation as to why legal issues are important to people. You know, the people that are interested in the money issue, people that are interested in the tax issue. You know, you need to have a good understanding of legal principles because they can just pop out in everyday American society. And, you know, if you're familiar with these legal principles, then you can make these legal principles a part of the national discussion regarding whatever problem the national media, the national discussion is occupying. Let's get around to Obamacare. Why was Obamacare passed? Obamacare was enacted, it was drafted by Obama and his folks, and they wanted to address the problem caused by people who are not insured. Now let's, you know, just like we used, you know, a percentage of the driving public in my Tennessee example, let's use a percentage in reference to the problem being created by uninsured Americans. Let's say that uninsured Americans, those that have no medical insurance and therefore causing the problem, let's say that they constitute 10% of the American populace. Well, then, you know, if you come along and you make this law applicable to an abridging of the rights of 100% of the public, including those who are not a cause of the problem, then you have an over-inclusive classification for equal protection purposes. The principle of you can't create over-inclusive classifications, you know, that equal protection principle is violated in this situation of Congress using the excuse of a percentage of the American public causing problems for the American medical system, using that as the excuse to take over and affect 100% of the American public and trampling upon their rights, preventing them from having a medical care that they choose and that they have provided for, you know, such a law is violative of equal protection principles because it is an over-inclusive classification. Now let's look at it a little bit different. A problem regarding Obamacare. Let's say that, you know, we focus in on the people that were the author of that legislation who were telling us that it was being caused The problem is created by the uninsured. Now let's come along and say, oh, the law that Congress passes, that it's Obamacare, it doesn't affect the people that are causing the problem. It's only applicable to those who are uninsured, who are also redheaded. So now you would see that that type of Obamacare law addressing only a part of the problem, that is what's called an under-inclusive classification for equal protection principles. So here you can see that once you become conversant with an understanding of these equal protection principles, it has a direct application. You know, something like Obamacare pops up, it becomes a part of the American discussion. You know, you see these people promoting certain things. You see, you know, the legislation get passed. You know, we all experienced what happened with Obamacare. Now, isn't Obamacare, doesn't it have substantial equal protection problems? Now, let's flip around to the gun issue. We've had here in the last, since the summer, we had the El Paso situation. You know, some guy, allegedly, went into, was it a Walmart in El Paso and did some shooting up. You know, we had one in Ohio, and, you know, we've had some out in California, and then we had the queer situation down there in Orlando, Florida, and then we had the Jewish synagogue. Where was that? In Cincinnati, Joe? Is that where that was? I forgot.
Was it Philadelphia?
Maybe Philadelphia. But in any event, what we got is, and there's, you know, I don't necessarily say that these are only limited to nuts and fruitcakes. You know, I think there's a whole lot more at play here than just nuts and fruitcakes who are going off the deep end and, you know, shooting things up. You know, there may be a lot more to it than that. But in any event, these proposals for gun control are being caused by an infinite, you know, an extremely small segment of American society. It is not being caused by the vast bulk of the law-abiding, gun-owning public. Would you agree, Joe?
Absolutely.
It's less than 1% of 1% of the people that are causing this problem. And yet, the liberals want to use this small segment of society. We need legislation to address that problem. No, what they want to use that as an excuse to affect the constitutional rights of the law-abiding, gun-owning public. Now, using these equal protection principles, you can see that what the liberals are wanting to do in reference to gun legislation, their proposal is going to be violative of equal protection principles, and specifically, it will be an over-inclusive classification. They need to instead to not violate equal protection principles, and they need to hone in on the people who are causing the problem. If they only hone in on people that are a small part of, a percentage of the people that are causing the problem, that will be an under-inclusive classification. If they include more people than those that are involved, that are causing the problem, that will then be an over-inclusive classification. So that's the, you know, I wanted to explain that to our listeners, you know, to here you have a constitutional principle that people need to know about. And if you know about these constitutional principles, you can see them in everyday life. And that is the reason why Joe and I and John O'Connor and Gary Thomason, we like to come on every week, every Wednesday, come along, and we need to teach people, you know, we need to get people away from these baseless arguments that float around in patriotic circles. We need to give them real meat. And the reason why we're giving you real meat is because we think it's real important for the people to understand, you know, have a real good understanding about how two planks of the Communist Manifesto are operating today here in America. And one of those is the second plank of the Communist Manifesto. And another one of those is the fifth plank of the Communist Manifesto. Oh, Joe, an ambulance just went by outside.
I thought they were coming for you, Larry.
Yeah. They're coming to take me away. But now, Joe, I think it's real important. You know, there's a lot of people that are interested in these issues. You know, they understand that there is activity that goes on in court. Now, last week, what we covered was, you know, a quick background of, you know, the development of criminal justice principles, you know, the current practices, the current criminal justice practices that we have here in America, you know, throughout the whole country. You know, we traced real quickly from 1066 forward, you know, when William the Conqueror conquered England and established feudalism in England in 1066, you know, that begins the foundations for the criminal justice system that we have today. And, you know, last week we talked about, you know, there is kind of an evolution, so to speak, of the criminal justice system that we have here today. You know, if you go back a couple of hundred years ago, one of the things we were talking about last week is, you know, hey, 150 years ago here in America, you know, a defendant couldn't testify in his own case, in a criminal case. And, you know, that principle lasted until in the late 1960s when the Supreme Court of the United States addressed that problem that still existed in Georgia at that time. Well, you know, I think it's real important for people to have a background, you know, an understanding, you know, even if all you do is listen to people like us talk about this stuff, it is at least educational. Now, you know, there's a lot we could get into in addition to criminal procedure, but I think last week was a good introduction. But Joe, I would like to kind of end what we were talking about last week in reference to criminal justice. Can you pull up the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure? Now, you can get, you know, that you can, this copy right here, you don't need to buy a book. You know, now, when I was in law school, you know, we didn't have the internet. And, you know, we had to buy these books. We bought the Federal Rules. You know, they were textbooks. We studied them. But, you know, you can download all this. And I think it's really important, you know, even if you just spent a little bit of time, you know, looking at it, you know, so that you have a blank mind. You know little or nothing about the criminal justice system. You know little or nothing about how the criminal justice system is structured. What are the various steps that somebody goes through as they travel through the criminal justice system? Now, just taking a look at and spending a little bit of time, you know, even if you sat down and, you know, download it on the internet off some government website, if you want to get the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, just type that into an internet search engine and this document will come up. And so you can sit down and you can read. Joe, there's not but about, you know, there's a total number of what, 83 rules, and they're arranged in a particular order. Yeah, 61, it's 83 in civil. But, you know, you can see that, you know, basically all that somebody that's interested in the system, you know, just going reading up through getting into the 40s in reference to the criminal rules, that's all you really need to know about. So Joe, kind of go down to, you can see they're broken into to these little titles of preliminary proceedings, like the complaint and indictment, preliminary hearing. You know, what happens in, you know, federal cases that are felonies have to be started by means of an indictment, but people can be arrested pursuant to a complaint. But a complaint can be also used to start a misdemeanor case. And so here you see these rules that relate to those things. Joe, kind of go through Title V venue. trial and, you know, post-trial starts at Rule 32. And so you're not talking about a lot of rules. And just simply sitting down and looking at these various rules and just reading a little bit, even if you don't understand it, you know, just that beginning step of just looking at it and beginning to pattern, you know, seeing a pattern, getting that pattern in your mind leads you to a greater understanding of the system. Now, that's something you can do with the criminal rules. Now let's take a look at the civil rules, Joe. So that's a separate document. You can close this one out. Okay. Yeah. Is that civil? It is. Now go down to, you know, get into the 40s of the rules. In the 50s. Now, what I'd like to talk about is, you know, these are the rules that we have today. You know, the federal rules were, the federal courts came out with, the federal system came out with written rules of procedure first. And then the states came along, and by and large, a lot of the states have come along and have patterned their state rules of civil procedure on the federal. And the reason why is because there was a lot of work that went into preparing and creating the federal rules of criminal procedure. And that's the reason why a lot of states have come along and kind of patterned their own rules. You know, they're similar, but they follow this pattern, but they're a little bit different. You know, every state has something similar to and different from the federal rules. But let's get back into the reason why we have rules. You know, I think last week we were talking about, you know, here in 1066, William the Conqueror came over and conquered England, established feudalism in England. Not that feudalism didn't have a grasp on England before that time, you know, but that's the beginning of, you know, what, in reference to our legal system, that's the beginning of the system that we have today regarding law. You know, we were colonies of England. And, you know, English law really goes back to and has its start, even though the jury trial provision predates 1066, you know, but by and large, the whole system we got in reference to English common law arises from that date. You know, it involves events and things that happened subsequent to 1066. And then, of course, we have inherited that. You know, as I said last week, you know, in reference to civil trials back in those days, you know, we were talking about how the printing press didn't exist in the 11th century, 12th century, 13th century, 14th century. You know, the printing press made books available. You know, that's the foundation for books. You have a printing press, now you can create books. Now that you have books, you have to have a society that can read. And, you know, to educate people with written material, you need a lot of books. So the printing press really changed Western society. It really changed English society. And before that time, you know, everything, you know, they had law schools in England. You know, they called them inns of court back in those days. But it was all, you would go to a law school to learn, and you were taught orally. You didn't use books. You attended these lectures. You know, these lectures, these professors that would be educating, you know, the people that want to be lawyers back in those days, you know, it was based on their experience. You know, they were educated in that field. And when I say educated, it wasn't by book learning. It was by trial and error and dealing with others. And that's the way the English criminal and civil system was developed. And as I said last week, you know, in those days, you know, let's say it's 1304, just to pull out a wild date. You know, and two parties have got a case going on, and some, chancery court in England. Well, the judge of that court would come to that community and hold sessions, and, you know, these parties would come to court, and they didn't have courthouses back in those days. You know, they had fields, and they would bring chairs and benches out to a field, and people could come and watch these trials, and juries could be called in to decide contested issues. But the people that they were there to observe a trial, you know, there was a division between the participants in the trial and the mere observers. And there was a log called a bar that separated the observers from the participants in a trial. And that's where the word bar became the basis for bar associations.